Welcome to another episode of the Functional Nerds. This is number 37. My name is Patrick Hester. I am an author and blogger and an all-around functional nerd. And my partner in crime is Mr. John Anelio. Say hello, John.
Hey, I'm John. I write songs about science fiction and fantasy. You can get a lot of my music for free at johnanelio.blogspot.com. I also do a video blog for wired.com called Geek Dad Guitar Lessons, and you can follow me at twitter.com/johnanelio. This week, we actually interviewed Clay and Susan Griffith. They have a book out from Pyre right now called Vampire Empire.
I think it's called The Grey Friar, and then it's Vampire Empire.
No, I have the book right in front of me. It's called
Really?
Vampire Empire, Book One, The Grey Friar.
Well, then why is it on Pyre? Does it say The Grey Friar?
Well, that's
Vampire Empire Book One.
Well, I'm sitting here with the book right in front of me, and I'm telling you, it says Vampire.
Oh, you know what's hilarious?
What's that?
I'm looking at the cover that you're looking at. I'm looking at it online.
Okay.
And on Amazon, it's listed as The Grey Friar, paperback. And on the, I see what you're talking about. On the cover, it giant letters, Vampire Empire. Tiny little letters, Book One, The Grey Friar.
Yeah, I mean, I guess technically it's called The Grey Friar and Vampire Empire is the series. But
we call that marketing.
Yes, exactly. But anyway, we interviewed Clay and Susan, who were just delightful people, and had a great conversation with them about the book and about their work in comics. So I think you guys are going to love this interview. Here you go. All right, and on the line we have Clay and Susan Griffith, authors of Vampire Empire, Book One, The Grey Friar. Why don't we start with Susan? Susan, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about Vampire Empire and what they can expect if they want to pick up the book?
Well, Vampire Empire, Book One, The Grey Friar is basically a compilation of a bunch of various loves of ours, including steampunk, alternate history, vampires, obviously, romance. It's one of those kind of books that just sort of is a hodgepodge of genres. So you're pretty much, regardless of what genre you like, you're going to find something in Vampire Empire. And it basically starts with an alternate history where the vampires rose up in 1870 and basically decided to take over the world. And so humans were forced to flee to the southern, to the equator, because vampires are a little bit sensitive to heat. And so they stay more up in the north. And it's been a good number of years. I think it's 150.
Mm-hmm.
The humans are about to reclaim what the vampires took back from them. So that's, and basically the story revolves around a hero and a heroine, mainly the legendary mass figure of Grey Friar, and she is the Princess Adela of the human Equatorian world. So. Hopefully it's got a little something for everybody.
Well, it does, you know, and I just finished reading the book today, actually. And, you know, I remember Pyre editor Lou Anders. I remember him sort of – who's that guy? I remember hearing him on – I forget which podcast I was listening to, but he was sort of talking up, you know, the fall and winter releases. And I remember when he mentioned this one and, you know, he was describing it as, you know, a mashup of steampunk and vampire stuff and alternate history. And I remember thinking like, oh, that's like – all the hot things right now. And I remember thinking like, oh, I wasn't sure how interested I'd be in reading it. But, you know, I just finished it, and it's not a book that's just sort of playing to what's popular now. It's a really,
they're not sparkly.
No, they are not sparkly. The vampires in this, not at all. And, I really loved it. And as Susan just mentioned in her, background of the book, I think the steampunk element really just comes from the the world building that you guys did in terms of the event in the book that you mentioned, the Great Killing, where the vampires rose up and took over, you know, humanity and sort of kind of kept people in the sort of technology of the 1800s. So I thought for a steampunk book, it actually really explained why it was steampunk. So I thought that was really great. Now, in your bio, it says that you guys were married in Scotland, and much of the book takes place there and throughout Europe. So could you guys tell us maybe something about your experiences there and how they may have impacted the book?
We've been married for 15 years. And when we decided to get married, we wanted to do two things. We wanted to get married and we wanted to travel. And we couldn't afford to do both. So we decided to travel and get married at the same time. And as it turns out, Scotland was one of the easiest countries legally for an American to go and get married very quickly. Susan had an abiding love of Scotland even before we went. So that cinched the deal. We went over there and we just fell in love with Edinburgh, which was the city we spent most of our time, and where we actually were married at Greyfriars Kirk, which is a famous medieval church in the city. And we just, it was just a city that, being horror buffs and pulp fans and adventure story fans, it still reeks of that old 18th, 19th century atmosphere. We fell in love with the city, and when we started working on this project, it made sense for us to set part of it there. And of course, we named our hero the Greyfriar after the church where we were married.
And did the love of Scotland have anything to do with Highlander?
No, actually, it was. It was based on Elizabeth Peters' Legend in Green Velvet, which is an old classic, one of her very first books, and took place in Edinburgh and in Scotland, and that's when I just fell in love with Scotland.
Mine came from a love of the famous body snatchers Burke and Hare. I come at it from a slightly less romantic angle,
right?
I'm one of the few people who. On our honeymoon, Susan didn't accompany me, but I went to the Museum of the Royal College of Surgeons because I had heard they had Burke's skeleton there. Unfortunately, I went to the wrong museum. His skeleton was at a different museum, but I did see a wallet made from his skin, so that was well worth the trip.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm certainly not going to go on that one. But he did get locked in there, too, so yeah. He had a nice frightening experience, which I missed completely.
Yeah, it was great.
Well, you know, and what I wanted to, and I think, you know, sort of you guys describing what your experiences were like, I think it kind of makes sense after reading the book and now talking to you guys a little bit about, you know, I just feel like there's a real authentic feeling to the book. It doesn't seem like, you know, a lot of times, you know, again, how it's being marketed is like the steampunk alternate history vampire. It's like, it's almost like, oh, we'll just slap these things together because they're in now and we'll do it. But it seems like, and that's what I felt reading it. But now in talking to you, it seems like it's a real authentic thing for you.
We've been working on the book actually for quite some time. It was originally conceived many, many years ago. It was going to be a comic book project. And as we developed it, we thought, no, this is too deep. This is too good. Let's work on it as a novel. So actually, the vampire craze came and went several times over the course of us writing the book. And of course, every time it would fade, we'd go, oh, well, we missed it. Oh, this is terrible. And it just so happens that we got it out at this time when vampires are hot again. Steampunk is hot. We never really set out to write a steampunk book. It was, as you say, sort of a neo-Victorian world simply because we like the Victorian world. And it fit in nicely with the resurgence in steampunk interest now. So it's one of those cases where it looks like we got all the major trends and put them together, but in fact, the trends were there, and we just got lucky they happened to be hot when our book was.
And we're fans of the trends. I mean, that was.
Well, that's why they're there. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, we didn't put them in because we thought they'd be really, you know, it'd be perfect timing. It was because we're all fans of those. We're fans of the vampires. We're fans of the alternate history. The fans of the steampunk. So it's a love, not just a marketing scheme.
Right.
Four or five years ago, someone might have said, why are you doing Neo-Victorian? That's pointless. No one's interested in the Victorian era now. Well, stuff always comes back around.
Of course. Well, and it reads that way too. It reads as being a very, you know, authentic, you know, love of both of you. So, I mean, and now when I wrote out on Twitter that I was going to start reading this book, you know, a couple weeks ago, and I have to say, a lot of the people that I kind of follow on Twitter were also reading the book, and it's getting nothing but, at least from the people that I associate with, nothing but rave responses. Someone said they like knocked it off on a Saturday, you know, said they like they picked it up in the morning and couldn't, you know, could have put it down until they finished it and read it all in one day. So it's getting some real positive reviews from the people that I know. So hopefully it's building some nice excitement. Good.
I have a question. So it's hard enough collaborating with another author on a book. How does that work when you're married?
It's very precarious. Actually, with Clay and I, we've been together for so long. Even though we've been married 15 years, we've actually known each other over 20 years.
Longer than that.
Actually, yeah, longer than that. It's probably about 25 almost now. But we've always sort of played off each other. We both were wanted to be writers, even when, you know, before we met. And so when we first met in a bookstore, of all places, we wound up reading each other's stuff. We used to pass stuff back and forth all the time, and edit each other's stuff. So we sort of became comfortable with that. But you know, as with any collaboration, you know, you have to have that give and take, that ability to trust your partner. And the thing is, we both like each other's works. We both know we're qualified and capable authors. So it was always an easy marriage of both, you know, our actual marriage and of our professional work as well. So we spend a lot of time, you know, talking over meatloaf and everything else. And we always talk about work. I mean, we always talk about writing, and that's kind of both good and bad. You know, you don't escape it, but, you know, the thing is, we never have, I just blanked.
Arguments?
Well,
no.
We have a lot of arguments. But
my God.
The key is, I think, if you're working with a writing partner in general, and something, a real disagreement comes up, it's just too easy to say, ah, screw it. You know, I think I'll just do my own thing. We're obviously not on the same page. Well, we can't do that. I mean, ultimately, if we did that, it would be a divorce, and that's a bad thing. So you have to work through the problems. You can't say, no, we're not. Ah, let's just go do our own thing. I'm tired of working with you. You can't do it. So we're forced to compromise, and so we're forced to work through our issues. And ultimately, every single time it happens, you look back on it and you say, you know, the solution we came to is better than either my solution or your solution individually. It always works out better.
Gotcha.
Well, it's for the best for the book. I mean, neither one of us are going to sabotage the other for ego. We are out to make, you know, to write the best book we possibly can.
Sure.
And so if somebody's speaking up and saying something, there's a reason. You know, we're not here because, you know, I want my passage to be in the book or my character has to stay in the book. I mean, if my character has to go, he has to go for the good of the book. And you just have to be strong enough and trust your partner enough that the reason he's saying, you know, old Thomas really can't be in this book, and he gives a reason, you have to understand. And now there's a lot of arguing. There's a lot of, you know, we go to public places a lot to make sure that the yelling stays to a minimum and the hot coffee doesn't get flung around or whatever. So, but you know, overall, I mean, we both trust each other to know to realize that the book is, you know, the final end be all basically for, you know, for the reader.
Well, you know, and I find the idea of co-novelists to be so interesting because, you know, quite often, you know, when you think of a novel, it's you know, a singular vision. And in reading this, I didn't – it really had a consistent tone throughout. And I was curious, you know, how you guys divided the work. We had Kevin J. Anderson on the phone. sorry, that's my actual phone ringing. We had a
Welcome to the world of podcasting.
Yeah,
folks.
Sorry about that. Though. So I normally record a mic.
Kevin J. Anderson is on the phone. Like,
and then it rings.
Yeah, I have Kevin J. Anderson on the line right now. No, we had him on the podcast, and he co-writes some of the Dune novels with Brian Herbert, and I believe that he says what they normally do is they alternate chapters. So I was wondering how you guys divide the work, you know, in terms of who writes what and how you guys go about doing that.
We sort of do that. What we do now, we write different things. I mean, right now, obviously, we're talking about Vampire Empire, but we write comics and we've written short stories as well. But in terms of a novel, basically, what we do, we plot it out in a lot of detail, basically chapter by chapter. And then we split it up. We don't necessarily do, I do one, she does two, I do three, she does four. We don't do that. But we'll write sections. Or if there's a chapter with characters that one of us particularly likes or has a particular strength with, we'll do that. And then, once we go off and write our own chapters, we just hand them back and forth, over and over and over. Eventually, we combine it into a manuscript, and then we each read through it many times to create that, among other things, to create that singular voice you're talking about, so mm-hmm. that someone doesn't say, oh, well, Clay wrote chapter 12, I can tell, and Susan wrote chapter 15, I can tell. We don't want that.
Yeah, and
go ahead.
No, so I was going to say, I was just going to agree that I didn't feel that at all. It did feel very consistent throughout. So, Susan, what were you going to say? I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, basically, that when we divide up our different chapters, we look also with, you know, who's got, we have our strengths and our weaknesses. You know, I'm not as great at world building as Clay is. Clay is very meticulous about that. I'm very good with characters and relationships and, you know, and so when you see a chapter come through and it's going to be more on a relationship basis or it's going to be an action basis or there's going to be a world basis, you know, we can make our decisions based on that going, you know, Susan makes really great action sequences, give that to her, or, you know, this is a really great villain sequence, it's going to, you know, require a lot of politics, you know, let's give that one to Clay. And so we sort of look at, when we're dividing the chapters up, not just as Clay said, but also in addition to looking at, you know, where our particular strengths and weaknesses lie. And we can, you know, it's great that I can rely on Clay to sort of pick up those political pieces that I'm not quite as good at. You know, we both write each other's stuff. Yeah, you know, I still dabble in politics, and he still works on great character scenes. But overall, if, you know, depending on what those scenes are, we can, you know, lean on the person who's a little bit more of the master of those scenes.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things in reading it, and I guess I was probably about three quarters of the way through the book when it kind of hit me of sort of the real advantage of having not only co-authors, but a married couple being co-authors and, you know, a man and a woman, is that I started realizing, oh, you know, the female lead and the male lead are equally compelling. And I think that's very hard to pull off. I've read, you know, lots of epic fantasy and, you know, science fiction. And then recently I've read a decent bit of urban fantasy where it's, you know, generally female protagonists where the males are almost more, you know, the romantic interest more than anything else. And I kind of realized towards the end, I'm like, no, in this book, this is really two main lead characters, and I really felt like that was probably an advantage. Is that something that you guys thought about in putting this together, of having sort of two leads almost?
We certainly try. Susan could probably do it better than I from the get go. She her male characters tend to be strong, and her female characters are excellent. My female characters traditionally are weak. That's why part of the reason she's here is to make sure that the women act properly. They don't just act like men wearing skirts. On the other hand, sometimes her men act like women wearing pants. So, you know, I can step in and go, I can see some guys talking this way, but this guy can't talk that way. This guy can't act that way. He has to be, you may not like him if he acts this way, but because of the man he is, he's going to do this.
It'll be truer to the character.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that, because that you're right. Part of it is just the nature of sometimes a novel where you have a main character and then you have a secondary character, whether it's a man or a woman. But yeah, I think a lot of that is a reflection of the gender of the author quite often, where women tend to write women better and men tend to write men better, or more believably, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Certainly true in my case. From some early manuscripts that she read of mine, my women are not strong.
So, now you guys, you had mentioned that you guys have written comics, and I looked in your bio that you guys wrote The Tick for a while, and so maybe you could tell us a little bit something about your background in writing comics and how writing comics differs from writing novels, and then
tell us how you get a gig writing Kolchak.
Oh yeah, well, we could do that. Do you want to talk about the comics versus novels?
Yes.
No, Susan.
Sure.
Yes, go ahead.
We met over a comic book, actually, X-Men.
X-Men number 101, I believe.
We both realized we both loved comic books, and Clay had a real passion for wanting to break into the business and become a comic book author. And
not an easy thing.
No. And he convinced me that I wanted to write comic books too. So we both started trying for it, and he made the break, and he got contacted by New England Comics, who owned The Tick. After Ben Edlund wrote his 13 episodes, they needed someone else to help show up, and I think Clay got. First, he got offered the Man-Eating Cow.
Yeah, I did the spinoff.
The
Man-Eating
spinoff.
Cow and Paul the Samurai.
But to me, they are like his. I love the Man-Eating Cow. It's still my all-time favorite stuff to read, of course. Because that was just spot on in just terms of the satire and just really clever.
I had little editorial control in those days.
Yeah. before we got control. But, you know, we wound up, he started breaking in first, and after a while he got a project from Acclaim Comics to write some Disney stuff. And Clay knows nothing about Disney. And
something about Disney.
You know something, but not as passionately.
There's a mouse involved in it.
And maybe it's
yes, Mortimer.
Exactly. And he got the Disney comics and decided that he would, you know, he needed a little help in achieving the Disney storylines and getting them just right. So he asked me to help out, and I was more than happy to jump in on that one. And that was the collaborative process when we realized that, you know, this is really working. But it was a match made in heaven, and we always we wrote comics any way we could, and New England finally offered us The Tick as well, and we were excited about that.
We never managed to break into the mainstream, I guess, which I assume would be Marvel DC. That's the mainstream. And if anyone from Marvel and DC are listening out there, we'd be. We'll write Spider-Man. We'd be happy to entertain Superman. We did the New England stuff with The Tick and the Kolchak deal. That was material published by Moonstone Books, and still is. They still do Kolchak. They're out of Chicago. I had some dealings with a very small press many, many years ago who had the license for Kolchak, had published one novel, and was looking to do more. So I pitched an idea, and the guy said, yeah, that's great. And I started working on it, and then the license fell apart, and the whole thing fell through. So then when I saw Moonstone had Kolchak, I contacted them and said, I have a little bit of background, and I've done The Tick, and I've done this. Are you interested? And we ended up doing a couple of things with Moonstone, several of which were Carl Kolchak, which was one of my dream jobs, Night Stalker.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh my God! Just that was my favorite fictional character when I was a young guy, and it was just a dream to suddenly we did both prose short stories and comics, and just to see or read Kolchak with our words coming out of his mouth, and it was just a dream come true. Just, I loved that character so much.
I did too, and I loved that he inspired the X-Files.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they brought that actor on the X-Files several times.
They did, and he was supposed to play a couple more episodes as well, but his health was failing, yep. And I think he only did the one, unfortunately, maybe two. But, yeah, it was great to see him on there. I'm a big Darren McGavin fan in general, not just as Kolchak, but from Christmas Story as well. But
oh, yeah. Well, and I mean, he was a great actor, but that was just a great character. And so, you know, when I was looking online for you guys and I came across that, I was like, oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, Kolchak's great.
Yeah, the beauty, you know, of some of, you know, of what we've been doing is we sort of hunt out what we really have a passion for.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I like pulp, so we were ecstatic to get the Phantom storylines and stuff like that. And, you know, that's you know, it's kind of surprising, but we've really had really great luck in getting
fun.
Some of our favorites.
Yeah, we've got a graphic novel coming out next year based on Alan Quatermain, the old African hunter character,
yep.
It's from Blue Water Comics, and we've done a couple of things for Blue Water, and I contacted the editor one day and said, hey, how about Alan Quatermain? He said, yeah, go ahead. So that's been a joy. We did some Ray Harryhausen stuff for him. It's not a living. We're not making a fortune off these comic projects, but we sort of use comics, just as Susan said, to play with these characters that we grew up with and mean something to us.
Sure.
So whether we get paid or not, the work itself is just such a joy, and we love doing these occasionally.
And it's a different kind of writing because you have to script it out and...
Oh, yeah, that's what you were supposed to talk about. yes, it's very, very different. It's short. Obviously, you know, word balloons only take up so much space, so people can only say so much.
Mm-hmm.
For a good comic book, you have to be extremely economical with space. If you've got 22 pages to tell a story, you can't spend, well, you can, but you shouldn't spend 3 pages with 2 guys staring at each other over a cup of coffee pretending that you're doing a movie, because you're not doing a movie, you're doing a comic book, and people are paying $3.50 for it, and they don't want to see 3 pages of artwork with 2 guys staring at each other over a coffee cup. They want to get their money's worth. So you've got to tell a story very tightly and not waste space and not waste words. And it's a challenge, and when it works, when you get an artist who is great, who really feels your script and gets into it, and we've had some good luck with a lot of our artists, it's wonderful. It's just wonderful to see a comic book come out that you really love, that you wrote. I love it.
And it's a great proving ground. I mean, it was a great exercise for us. We started out working, you know, trying to get novels published, but when we got into the comic book business, we really tightened our form. We really learned to look at the script and figure out what it is that's important to tell. What kernel do we need to pull out of these stories to put on in a comic book that, you know, is so limited in space. And that really has helped in terms of editing and everything. So
yeah.
it's a great proving ground for us.
Greyfriar is a pretty economical book. I mean, there's not a lot of fat on Greyfriar. Yeah. It's a small thing.
And that leads me into 2 questions. First, how many books are you planning in the Vampire Empire? And second, are you going to graphic novelize them when you're done?
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say it's... definitely 3 books. I mean, that's what Hire bought, and we'll definitely go that. I mean, we would love to take it further. We would love to do, like, prequel stories, like, you know, at the time of The Great Killing and, you know, and how the vampire culture rose up. But we will definitely get 3 books of the Adela and Greyfriar saga. And in terms of the comics, like I said, it was originally intended to be a comic, a manga-like comic book, except it just became so epic and it's such a great storyline that we decided not to go that route. But we would love to do a comic book version of that. No
sure.
doubt.
That's just a matter of licensing.
Yeah, Butcher's doing it with his Dresden Files. Why not?
Yeah, who's publishing that?
No, it used to be...
The Dabble Brothers?
It was the Dabble Brothers, and then they got sold, and I want to say now it's, I think it's Dynamite.
Oh, is it? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're not adverse to seeing it as a graphic novel. We're not adverse to seeing it as a movie, a video game, anything.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that with the movie, because I don't often think this when I'm reading, but as I got about halfway through it, I'm like, this would make a great movie. I could totally see this as a movie. So
we'd like to think so too. That'd be great.
Yeah.
We think in movies. I mean, we're both movie aficionados and, you know, big television guys, and you know, when we're writing, I wouldn't be, you know, I'm not lying when we say, you know, we envision that too when we're writing, and mm-hmm. but the book is, you know, it could definitely be a really cool movie. Just from
I think
characters.
So.
Well, it looks like Del Rey is publishing now, or Del Rey published the first Dresden comic, and now Dynamite's publishing. What do you call it? Stormfront
novels.
Stormfront.
Oh, okay. Dynamite does some nice.
They do. Yeah, they got some great stuff.
Cool. Well, I think we're getting towards the end of our time. So, Clay and Susan, why don't you guys, you know, we talked about the Vampire Empire book. Why don't you tell us when the next books in that series are coming out, and tell us any other projects that you have coming out that you'd like our listeners to know about?
Vampire Empire book 2 should be out in 2011. We're not exactly sure when. It may be late summer. It may be in the fall. The last date we heard was probably September, but, you know, a lot of things depend on production and stuff like that. Book 3 will then be out in 2012. What else we got? We have a couple of graphic novel projects coming out mainly from Blue Water Comics right now. The Quartermain should be out sometime in spring of 2011. We have a Ray Harryhausen graphic novel called It Came From Beneath the Sea Again, which I think will be out in December. And we have an issue of Blue Water's Vincent Price Presents, which I also believe will be out in September as well. I want people to look for that, particularly in addition to Quartermain, but since Quartermain's been delayed till next year, you'll have to wait. Vincent Price and Quartermain both have art by a guy named Patricio Carbajal, who's an Argentinian artist who should be working for every comic book company in America. This guy is awesome. He's fast, he's detailed, he's almost photorealistic, he's cinematic. Again, if Marvel DC guys are out there listening, look up this guy, Patricio Carbajal. He is an awesome artist, and he has he's a pro. He's not a flake. He is a pro. He gets the work done, and he does it the right way. I love this guy.
Great. Can you guys?
All we have.
Yeah. Well, why don't you guys throw out your website, and if you're on Twitter and Facebook and all that kind of stuff too.
You have it up, Susan?
No.
Okay, I've got it. Our website is a blog. It's clayandsusangriffith.blogspot.com. Obviously, you can just Google Clay and Susan Griffith. We are on Facebook. We each have our individual pages, which was a mistake, but that's the way it is. There's a Clay Griffith Facebook. There's a Susan Griffith Facebook. But for the fans of the book, there is a Vampire Empire page on Facebook. So
nice.
Go to Facebook, search Vampire Empire, all the latest updates and reviews and information, this awesome video that Susan put together, a trailer, which is just great, is linked up there right now. And we're on Twitter. We're Clay and Susan, at Clay and Susan. We're on Twitter.
We tweet.
So we tweet occasionally. We're not big tweeters. We're more Facebook guys, but we're trying to tweet more.
Yeah, I'm rarely on Twitter.
Yeah, I find it difficult to understand, but I'm old.
Not that old.
Old enough not to understand Twitter. But yeah. we're tweeting more and more. So that's where we are. We're all over the place, luckily.
Great. That sounds
good. The Facebook is, I think it's just facebook.com. Is it / Vampire Empire, all one word?
Yes, so Vampire Empire. Yeah.
You get to.
If you can find one of us, you can link Vampire Empire off of it. Or off of Pyre. Go to Pyre's website. You can link off of there. And go to Pyre's website anyway and check out all their other books as well. Pyre and Lou Anders does an amazing, amazing job of putting out really quality science fiction fantasy stuff. If you haven't sampled some of Pyre's stuff, you're missing out on some of the best speculative fiction out there right now.
Yep. Well, we do too. We're big fans of Pyre and of Lou too. So, well, Clay and Susan, thanks so much for giving us some of your time. You guys were an absolute delight to have on. And if ever you want to come on again to talk about other projects, you know, just don't hesitate to contact us.
Thank you. We enjoyed it.
Yes. Definitely.
Oh, great.
Thank you.
Great. Very good. Okay. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. And we're back. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed that interview with Clay and Susan as much as Patrick and I did. So make sure you go check out their book. Patrick, what do you have going on this week?
Let's see. As of this recording, I am writing something about the Google ebook store.
Hmm. Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. I'm because I find it interesting that they are they're trying to partner with independent booksellers. Mm-hmm. So the independent booksellers can sell ebooks and make a profit off of them, which I think is different.
Mm.
I don't know if I like it yet or not, so I'm still doing my research. Other than that, I don't know. I got the TV recaps for different stuff. There's not a lot on this week, so I don't know. But other than that, atfmb.com, twitter.com/atfmb, facebook.com/atfmb, all that kind of stuff. You'd think there's like a pattern there.
Yes. Yes, I sensed that pattern quite a while ago. So
I was even thinking about like going and getting atfmb.bandcamp.com.
Yeah, well, why not? I mean, you make some music, you never know. Someday you might do it. So
yeah, I'd have to pay people because I only play cover songs.
Oh, well, then you can just put it out for free. Well, actually, even if you put music out for free, you're still, if you put a cover out for free, technically, you're still supposed to pay for it. But
yep.
Anyway, anything else you got going on?
Not that I know of.
All right. Well, this week I just released a holiday EP on the aforementioned Bandcamp called Seasons Geekings. It has a great cover that Patrick did for me. He took a picture of his Christmas tree and made it look all artsy fartsy, and it looks great. So, Patrick, thanks for doing the cover of that. And
you're welcome.
That has a couple of older songs of mine. It has the Batman Smells, a rebuttal song, and it has the Millennium Falcon for Christmas, which is actually on my other album, but I thought, you know, might as well package it on a nice holiday mix.
Christmas time.
Yeah. And it also has a song called Is a Chupacabra Kosher? which I wrote for Ann Vandermeer asked me to put that, and Matt Staggs too asked me to put that together for their Kosher Guide to Mythological Creatures book. So
I knew you were going to say it, and I still laughed. It still makes me chuckle.
Here we go. When I was writing that, I'm like, I don't know if this is kind of just lame or too silly. And my wife, who is Jewish, when I played it for her, she bust out laughing and told me it's the best song I ever wrote, which I don't know if I agree with, but my wife says it's okay, so I went put it out. It has another song of mine called Winter Day, which is kind of an older song that hasn't really seen the light of day, so I was happy to get that out there. So you can go to johnnyelliott.bandcamp.com, pick that up. You can pay for it. You can get it for free.
You should pay for it.
Well, whatever people want to do.
I just
want people to listen, but thank you for that. And yeah, that's about it. All I have going on for this week, and twitter.com/JohnAnilio.
I did remember I am writing in my third short story, my short story a week.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Cool. Well, yeah. So
I am working on the third one. The third one is actually a rewrite of something I did a long time ago called Crossroad Blues.
Mm.
Set in the 20s.
Oh.
At a crossroads.
I see. Are you potentially going to be submitting that to some place that I think you should be submitting that to?
There is the potential for that if I can get it done in time, yes.
Right, because that's what to be due soon. Cool. Well,
And you should know, John, the Legend of the Crossroad.
I do. Of course I do. Robert Johnson. Is it based on... Oh, sweet.
And did you know that it wasn't actually Robert Johnson?
I did not know that.
It was Tommy. It was his friend who actually went to the crossroads. Oh. But that's not the character in this story. That's just something I think everybody should know as part of... Because what happened is some white guy somewhere wrote a book and decided that it was better to have the more famous blues guy be the center of the legend. And so he changed it to Robert Johnson.
I see. That takes place in the 20s, Robert Johnson? Like
actually, that was in the 30s, but okay. I am setting mine in the 20s. Gosh, yeah. I wonder why.
Close enough, right? Cool. Well, that's great. I look forward to reading that, Patrick, because I love all that, the old acoustic country blues stuff. So I'd be really curious to read what you wrote for that. So cool. Now, next week, I'm going to say it. Maybe it will fall through, but I've been sort of teasing that we have, you know, a pretty well-known author, and we're scheduled to interview him next week, and he should appear on the show, and that is Harry Turtledove. Yes, that's a pretty big get. So if he's not on the show next week, well, I apologize that it fell through, but everything's pointing to that. We're going to interview him next week, so looking forward to that.
for the listeners who have been with us for a while, John has been dying to top me for Mike Resnick.
Well, Mike Resnick's still pretty up there, so, you know. But anyway, and there is actually a Resnick connection in there. One of the short stories that's in the collection that I read was submitted for one of Mike Resnick's collections that he edited. So
nice.
There's a little bit of a connection there. But so look forward to that next week, and please join us then.
Yep. Bye.
All right, everybody, have a good week.
Is a Sasquatch kosher? Could it be served like tenderloin? Could you eat it with some chocolate coins? Is a Sasquatch kosher? Do you think it tastes like beef? Would its hair get caught between your teeth? Is a chupacabra kosher? How come all these goats are dead? Could you eat it with some challah bread? Is a chupacabra kosher? Or do you think that it's unclean? I guess I'll settle for some rice and beans.
After another couple of hours searching the hillside for El Chupacabra, we decided to end our foot patrols and go back to camp.
In terms of our investigation tonight, the criteria that we were using to investigate the Chupacabra was really, really visual.
And we didn't catch anything unusual on our cameras. Our chickens even survived the night.
Do I think the Chupacabra exists? I don't know. I think that there is enough evidence to support that there's something killing a lot of animals. And there's something that is being repeatedly cited by people who are living here.
They say that it is much bigger than a ferret.
As to what that is, I don't know, but there's something out there.